This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
And in this week's show, we have two main feature reviews. We're going to kick off with Arthur and Merlin, and moving on to Inheritance, starring a certain Simon Pegg. Our short shot this week is a short film called Pop Down, and we're going to round off with a bit of Chris Walken in our DTV throwback, McBain. So let's crack on. Our first review then is Arthur and Merlin, Knights of Camelot. King Arthur and his knights are waging war in France, leaving his son Mordred as protector of Camelot alongside Queen Guinevere. However, it's now been 8 years since Arthur left England, and all the killing has robbed him of his purpose and identity. Meanwhile, Mordred has started to have designs on the throne and Guinevere herself. Okay, so Rich, we have a bit of a cottage industry in the UK for this kind of movie.
Medieval sort of lowish tales. Budget.
Yeah. Sorry?
Medieval tales.
Medieval tales, yeah. We see a lot of this sort of stuff coming through, loads and loads of stuff to do with Romans and Arthur and Robin Hood, for example, and everything in between. Now, visually, this isn't too bad. Unfortunately, sort of plot-wise and sort of storytelling-wise and script-wise, not quite as strong as some of the ones we've seen, I believe. I think one of the issues is the kind of dialogue the characters are having to deal with. You know, Arthur asks somebody a question and they answer with, "I know not, my lord." You know, and you're thinking, it just sounds so clumsy. You know, you try to sort of put things into sort of like an oldie worldy speak, and it just doesn't work. It really doesn't, unfortunately. I'm going to throw this over to you for a bit and then I'll sort of add a few more comments. So what did you make of King Arthur and Merlin?
Right. So the film is the kind of medieval, you know, Knights of the Round Table story that I'm not a big fan of. It's not my cup of tea. You know, the one that always comes to mind for me is First Knight with Richard Gere. So that's the sort of King Arthur story that I enjoyed. But on the surface of it, I have no problem with this film. Apart from the fact that it's called Arthur and Merlin, Knights of Camelot. And where's Merlin? Where is he? Because he's in it for about 1 minute.
Yeah.
The first thing was Arthur and Merlin, Knights of Camelot. I was thinking Merlin's not a knight. That's weird. Why would you call it? Why would they call Merlin a knight? And then the cover is, the poster art is Arthur and Merlin. Merlin played by Richard Brake. And so you've got this kind of Nicolas Cage movie kind of thing. You're watching it and you keep waiting for. You keep waiting for Merlin to come up. It's like, and I think I wrote it down that he first appears at 35 minutes. And then it's like, not for long. And then he's gone until about an hour. And then I think he turns up maybe once more. But he pops up very briefly. So I'm like, there's like a massive marketing, you know, misleading marketing thing going on here, which really aggravated me. I understand why they do it. You know, Merlin's commercial. So, you know, there's already been a low-budget British film called Arthur and Merlin, which I guess is why they've had to call Arthur and Merlin Knights of Camelot. It's not related, completely unrelated, as far as I'm aware, but they've had to sort of qualify it. But they've gone... The original script to the movie, from what I can tell, was The Knights of Camelot, which makes sense, because that's what it's about. And if you called it The Knights of Camelot or Arthur and the Knights of Camelot, I would not have a problem with it, because that completely represents what the film is. But to try and market the film on Merlin just really, really annoying.
Yeah, I totally agree. The very first scene in this film sort of threw me a bit and had me quite worried. It shows Arthur and Lancelot riding horseback along the beach. And every time it's a long shot, it's quite far away. You can see two characters sort of riding the beach, riding horses. And then when you get close-ups, it's so tight on Arthur and Lancelot that you can't even see the horse. And I'm thinking, can these guys actually ride a horse, or are they being filmed on mountain bikes? Yeah, because that's kind of what it looked like. It looked like these guys are being filmed on mountain bikes, sort of look like they're riding a horse, and then sort of cut away. But then, as the scene ends, you actually see both of them on horseback, and they sort of manage to sort of turn around and sort of ride off. But it just looks so bizarre. I'm thinking, did they start this scene without these guys knowing how to ride, and then had to sort of hastily do it? It was very strange, because I don't think they ride horses again for the rest of the film.
Yeah, I think you're right. Again, that might be well, in part, it's where would they have got the horses from to a certain extent, but also budget maybe. This was shot probably on quite a restricted budget down in Wales. I think the budget has gone quite well on cost. In terms of costumes, I think that's all done really well. The locations are quite good. Some of the sort of the Camelot CGI sitting on a cliff, is a bit bare bones, but it's okay. The film was directed by a guy called Giles Alderson, who does a podcast himself actually called the Filmmakers Podcast. I'd be very interested to hear if he's going to cover or has covered how his film has been, marketed or retitled for marketing purposes. That would be quite interesting to hear about. But he previously made a film called The Dare, which I know you've seen.
Yes, now that was really good.
Very, very different kind of movie that, though.
Very different kind of movie to this. Yeah, absolutely. What they share is a similar look, because this does look pretty good. From a technical point of view, I think this is quite well polished. The guys behind the camera are doing a really good job, the lighting and everything. It's just some of the actors in it. For example, the guy playing Mordred, they've deliberately sort of styled him on the character Roose Bolton from Game of Thrones, who is like the real sort of hissable baddie and the sort of one of the towards the end of the series.
Is he in? Is he is he is the actor from Game of Thrones? Because I know
No.
this film, they are marketing it as like a Game of Thronesy kind of thing. There's like three members of the Game of Thrones cast are in this movie, including Richard Brake.
Yeah, no, I think they've
They've just gone for a
covered
similar character.
time exactly. Yeah, but he just kind of looks like he's escaped from some sort of indie goth band, basically. Sort of
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
vampire. He doesn't really come across as particularly scary sort of character, or someone who could sort of take over Camelot. But that's kind of me.
But aren't they always? They're always these kind of not
That
wimpy,
is
but
true.
sort of wet lettuce kind of villains. You see quite a
They
lot
are.
of them.
Now, my sort of like standard for this kind of film and this kind of budget is a film called Of Gods and Warriors, which came out a couple of years ago
Is that
now.
the Terence Stamp one?
Yes, it is.
Martin
Yeah, so
Ford.
he's in it short. Yeah,
Yeah.
they both have brief roles in it. Also manages to get in. I know that's a different one. That's directed by David L.G. Hughes. And the reason I like that one is because they spend so much time on the fight scenes and getting all the choreography and everything right. This isn't terrible. I thought they did a reasonable job. I didn't think they did a lot with Excalibur, really.
No, not a
The
lot. I
match
also
we get.
thought the use of Lancelot, because I think the film, if they were going to go for a recognisable name, the title should have been Arthur and Lancelot, because Lancelot plays a much bigger role.
And it's interesting, the there's a sort of tiny subplot, isn't there? Because you know, the actual story of sort of Arthur and that, we know that sort of like Lancelot fancied Guinevere, you know, or they're
love triangles. Well.
Yeah, and that kind of comes to a head at the end of this one. But it's very much an afterthought. It's just like, oh, that's happened. Which is
yeah.
Really weird. You know, that maybe didn't need to do that for this particular film. You know, it didn't need to sort of wrap everything, every single element up in one go.
In terms of the main story of like, okay, Arthur's away, there's a coup, he's got to, you know, he's kind of what, he's kind of become a shadow of his former self. He's kind of lost who he is. So then he's got to try and find himself, be worthy to get Excalibur back again. And reclaim Camelot. How do you, you know, and obviously take over the defeat the bad guy and stuff. So how did you, do you feel that story was well told, or you know, did you have any issues
not
with it?
Really, I found it a bit too ponderous. Really, I just thought they're sort of contemplating their own navel a bit too much about it. It kind of left me cold, I must admit. I was kind of a bit more interested in this sub. There was another subplot involving a female warrior who had a bit of an axe to grind. But it was one of those, again, it was one of those sort of muddled things where she's blaming him for the death of her father. And he's sort of saying, but he was a hero. And, you know, it's really, really bizarre.
Is that the bit where I was getting the sort of a Katrina Durden, I am vengeance, retaliation kind of vibe?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But it's just like, you could have done more with that, you know. Maybe try and win her onto your side or something, but no, bit of a wasted opportunity. How are we going to score this, Rich?
I'm going to have to go a 5 on this one.
I think I'm going to have to agree with you. I'd have liked to sort of score it higher, but it's technically well made. Got no issues with that at all. My main issues are with the script. It's a bit too ponderous. It goes down rabbit holes instead of sort of focusing what I wanted to do. And sort of the way it's been marketed, as Richard sort of alluded to, you know, it's trying to sell us something else altogether. So 2 5s for Arthur and Merlin, Knights of Camelot. Our next review is Inheritance. When her father suddenly dies of a heart attack, young District Attorney Lauren Munro is bequeathed in his will a very dark secret buried in the woods near their family home. Now, this was a very interesting film, Rich, or at least it started out as a very interesting film. Some nice editing at the opening to sort of give an idea of what's going on. So this woman's father is played by Patrick Warburton, although we only see him in a few scenes, has a heart attack and dies just as she's giving a big press briefing about this big corruption case that she's dealing with. And then it sort of starts settling down a bit into the actual sort of story. And we get to the point where the will is read, her dad's will is read. And she's left this thing, once everyone else has left the room, she's left this sort of secret. And I must admit, some of the visuals, you know, when she goes out to the forest and you get like the overhead shot and she pulls back the tarpaulin and reveals these set of stairs, I thought that was really, really cool. And then finding what she does inside. So we've got Simon Pegg playing a guy called John Monroe, who is being kept prisoner by her dead father in this underground bunker on the estate. And it's down to Lauren to figure out who this person is and why her dad's been keeping him there. What do you think of this one, Rich?
Yeah, I was trying to remember what Simon Pegg's character is, because I don't think it's Monroe, because that's...
It's Monroe, right.
Anyway, there's stuff going on with his character anyway. But the so Simon Pegg as Hannibal Lecter is sort of kind of what you're getting a little bit here. You think it's just going to turn into a protracted sort of two-hander with Lauren Monroe, played by Lily Collins, Phil Collins' daughter, yeah. I think. And
Simon Pegg's
character. And so you think it's just going to, basically, it feels a lot like Silence of the Lambs kind of thing, or various mm-hmm. other sort of similar projects. But the sort of central conceit of it is that Simon Pegg's character has been locked in this room, imprisoned in this room, with a chain around his neck and whatnot, for 30 years. So you immediately think of like Old Boy as an example. But apart from sort of the Old Boy, Sons of Lambs kind of thing, I really like this a lot. I thought it worked really well to an extent. Very stylishly shot. Great cast. Connie Nielsen's also in there as Lauren Monroe's mother. Patrick Warburton's character is Archer Monroe, so it's his wife. Warburton's great, but whenever he delivers lines, you can't help but think of Joe from Family Guy. But the plot itself, the way it's sort of, secrets revealed, the burdens of these things, and discovering that, because they've got this, the family are wealthy, incredibly wealthy, and they've also all got very, powerful positions. Like Lily Collins is supposed to be a district attorney, although she looks like she's just out of school, she's so young. And her brother, William Monroe, he's like a senator, played by Chase Crawford. Now, interesting, as a side note, he's from The Boys, obviously, and Simon Pegg's in The Boys as well, so I thought that was quite curious as an aside. But another thing I was thinking of when I was watching it was Gangs of London.
Oh, yeah.
Have you watched Gangs of London?
Only the first couple of episodes.
Oh, okay. Well, as the story unfolds, the main character, learns things about his family that sort of tear down the sort of veneer of the respectability that he did. Although it's different in Gangs of London because it's about gangsters and they kind of know what they're all about, but there is that kind of striving for respectability. And in this, they're a very respected family and there's a lot at stake. There's twists and turns along the way, but it does go, Pegg gets a chance to go full Cage. It's, real sort of raging, I guess, scenes. I thought as the case with a lot of thrillers, the ultimate payoff is not as satisfying as you would hope. For me, it wasn't anyway. But overall, I thought it was really good. It's made by a guy called Vaughn Stein, who previously worked with Pegg on a film called Terminal. With Margot Robbie.
Margot Robbie, that was pretty horrible, unfortunately, yeah.
I heard it wasn't great, but I don't really know. I haven't seen it, so I can't judge much about it. No, but this one,
I reviewed it back on the old Spoken Lamb.
Right, that's probably where I'm thinking of, yeah.
Not good. Yeah, I enjoyed this one quite a lot as well. It took a while to sort of get used to Simon Pegg's American accent.
Yeah, it always does, I find. Yeah, I mean, Lily Collins is really good, but Pegg's is a bit tougher.
Yeah. Well, the editing was quite snappy. I like there was a few flashbacks to when Simon Pegg's character was a lot younger, which I really liked as well. Obviously played by a different character, but they managed to sort of convey that, yes, this is the same person sort of thing, quite well. The payoff at the end, I must admit, I didn't know which way it was going to go. It was either going to be nicely all wrapped up, or it was going to be really horrible. It almost seemed like horror movie sort of territory.
Yeah.
The way it was headed, which is really interesting. I'm thinking, are we going to get something incredibly cynical happen, at the end, which is... You just didn't know which is cool because it was an unknown quantity. I'm with you in that the reasons, you know, the motives for keeping him there and that seemed a bit thin. You know, it wasn't, well, I don't know. You know, you get this sort of like final twist right at the end, you know, just before somebody takes things in, it takes action, justice in their own hands kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, I thought overall this was pretty decent. It's, a different kind of story to one we've seen. It's quite unique in that way. So, yeah, definitely give this a shot. What are you going to score it?
I'm going to go high end 7 on this.
Yeah, it's definitely a 7 for me for this one as well. It's different. It's not usual sort of procedural sort of film. It's got some great characters, a lot of good actors in this. Check it out. 7s out of 10 for Inheritance. Our short shot this week is Pop Down. After returning home from university, young Jess is in a bit of an emotional slump. That is until a strange alien arrives at her bedroom window. This is directed by a Welsh filmmaker called James Button. I reviewed some of his work before. We did a really good short called The Corpse Series. And this one, it's very sweet. He recorded this, he filmed this during the lockdown period with the pandemic. And I think it's a good sort of, metaphor for people sort of feeling isolated and, you know, not being able to express themselves. So we have a young lady called Jess who, as I said, has returned from university, doesn't really know what to do with her life, can't really sort of seem to reconnect with her family. And then this sort of weird alien guy sort of turns up at the window. Rich, how did he get on with this?
Yeah, it was good. I mean, it wasn't filmed during the lockdown. It was released during the lockdown. It came out in May, but it was made last year, 2019. So, I don't really have a lot to say about it. It's nice. It's sweet. It's basically a Welsh Mork and Mindy.
It is, yeah. But I think it's a good showcase for James Button's acting. I think he's got a really good sense of comedy timing, which I really get on with, which came out in his previous film, The Corpse Series. I think he does really well here as this sort of very quirky alien, trying to get to grips with the English language and, sort of all the weird things that Jess has got in her room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're a likable pair.
Yes, and as you said, you know, there's not really a lot we can talk about, but we can recommend it. It's definitely worth checking out. Check out some of James's other shorts as well. If you click on the link in the footnotes for this film, you'll see others that he's got there, like the Road Rage one, which is pretty good. He also did a travelogue video of a trip he and a friend did across to America. I think they did two. One was when Trump was first inaugurated as president, and then one a couple of years later. And they are sort of fascinating sort of travelogues.
And the When in America series.
Yeah, that's it. Made in America, yeah. This is really sweet. It's sort of quite prescient, you know, with sort of the whole lockdown thing, people being isolated, and, you know, just having somebody to ask, are you okay? I thought it was a nice sort of touch to this. I thought it helped quite well. It's, you know, zero special effects or anything like that. All filmed in one little sort of bedroom with a couple of external shots, and that is it, basically. You know, it's sort of textbook streamlined filmmaking.
Yeah, and if you go to jamesbuttonfilms.com, you'll be able to find links to a number of his films. Obviously, we've got the pop down link link in the notes. But yeah, do visit his website and have a look at, you know, what else he's done, which is, you know, he's done quite a considerable amount of stuff, as Mike's been saying.
Yeah, definitely a fan of his work. So yeah, check him out. That's Pop Down by James Button. Our D2B throwback this week is McBain. On the last day of the Vietnam War, Bobby McBain is rescued from a POW camp by Roberto Santos and his squad, creating a debt of honor between them. Fast forward 15 years and Santos is now the leader of a rebellion in Colombia, who is tragically murdered live on TV. When Santos's sister comes to collect on his debt, McBain puts the old squad back together and heads down to Colombia to kick some ass. They just don't make them like this anymore, Rich.
Well, they do. They just make them differently, I think. It's just, I mean, when I was watching it, I was thinking, this is the Expendables led by Christopher Walken, which is very unusual.
It is, yeah. This is directed by James Glickenhaus, who also did films like The Exterminator. It's another sort of classic Vietnam.
The Protector as well, wasn't it? The Jackie Chan movie. Did he do that one?
Yes, I believe he did. This starts out in Vietnam with a squad of, Santos and his men, which includes Steve James, we have to say.
Yep.
From American Ninja and all the other sort of canon movies that he did. But and just as they're flying home, they actually fly over a POW camp and decide to sort of go and do something, in the midst of which we have McBain in this sort of Thunderdome-style sort of cage match.
Yeah.
Which goes down really well, I must admit. So I really like the setup for this. And then sort of 15 years later, we get sort of stuff with Maria Conchita. What's the surname?
Maria Conchita Alonso.
Alonso. I was almost called it almost. Alonso, yeah. And her brother, who's Santos, of course. And this rebellion which goes on, you know, they get trapped, sort of blackmailed with the sort of death of some innocent civilians. And he gives himself up and is killed live on TV, which McBain just happens to be watching in his bar in New York. So there's this great scene of Maria heading to New York to collect on this debt. And, you know, she gets to New York, finds out where McBain's working. He's a steel worker. He's up on the top of the Brooklyn Bridge doing a bit of welding. And as soon as she arrives, he lifts up his helmet, looks at it and goes, "I've been expecting you." And I thought, that is so fucking cool. it was just so cool the way he just turns around, you know, looks at it and goes, "Yeah, I've been expecting you." He knew exactly what that somebody was going to come and collect that debt. And then we get this sort of putting the team back together and then heading down to Colombia to, you know, stage a coup, basically.
Yeah, in sort of typical A-teamy kind of fashion, I guess. Or the Magnificent Seven, whichever one you want to pick, or Dirty Dozen, I don't know. But it's a film that sort of pulls in a lot of different directions. It starts out quite unusually with a very somber ballad being played over the. So it's not like a pumping sort of action thing. It's very sort of thoughtful opening to the film, which I didn't know until the end was a song by Mark Knopfler, originally performed by his band Dire Straits.
Yes, yeah, Brothers in Arms.
Brothers in Arms, yeah. So I didn't know that when I was. I was just thinking, this is really weird song, because it's a very feminine, you know, it's a woman singing the song as well. So it's got this very feminine sort of feel to this big. So what's going to be an action movie? But I guess that, you know, that kind of plays into Maria Conchita Alonso's character and sort of the influence that she has it on the story. But so it starts out at the end of the Vietnam War. So the war's, they've just been told it's over and the platoon are just flying away. And then they spot, you know, oh, there's a guy down there needs help or whatever. And they go back and they sort of agree. Are we going to go back? Yeah, let's go back. So it's kind of got this, we get a chance to sort of win Vietnam thing going on. You know, so there was a lot of that sort of around the time, you know, with like Rambo 2 and that, you know, do we get to win this time? So, you know, kind of kind of feel to it. So there's that, and then it jumps forward in time, and obviously we meet up with those characters again. When Walken starts and they're like putting the team back together, kind of thing happens. It does kind of get a bit A-teamy because they sort of, well, there's a big action scene where they go and take out some drug dealers and stuff, where they end up meeting Luis Guzman.
Luis Guzman.
Yeah. Who's the one person they don't kill, not to give anything away. But they sort of kill all these guys, and then he's like, no, you know, you don't really want us. You want, you know, the big fish, kind of. And they point at it. But then, so Walken puts on a persona then, and he goes a bit Hannibal Smith. And he starts pretending he's a wise guy and stuff. So it's got this really weird structure. And then they start making their way to Colombia. And then there's this really long aerial combat section, which sort of comes out of nowhere. And he's like talks to a jet fighter pilot and gets him involved. So there's all these jets flying around. And then the jet pilot doesn't disappear. He actually says, actually, I want to join in with you guys. And so they feel like they grafted this element on, and then it goes down the old overthrowing a South American dictator route at the end. You know, where we've seen, you know, I mean, Coronado is a recent example of a film that kind of does that. But yeah, so it's quite unusual because it's called McBain, but Walken actually isn't in it. In terms of a principal character that much. The film isn't about McBain, and McBain actually doesn't play as big a role. He's there. Walken doesn't get that. Do you get what I mean? That he didn't get that many scenes?
No, that's right. Yeah, no, I totally agree.
No, he does say, but he does get to do some typical Christopher Walken scenes. So that one of his first big moments, really, in the film comes nearly about half an hour in, where he gets to give this speech, give this short monologue about Woodstock as a sort of he's trying to represent how he used to be quite idealistic and now he's very cynical. And so he's saying, look, you used to look at things one way and now, you know, I look at things very differently. And that's such a Walken kind of scene. You know, you're thinking of like Pulp Fiction and The Watch and all that kind of stuff. So you can kind of see what he's brought to it. He's kind of tried to do it. But doing the action stuff, it's actually quite weird seeing him do a bit of a Charles Bronson-ish kind of role, really. But it's mainly left to the other guys because it's very much an ensemble film, really.
Yeah, there's lots of things where he's kind of just sort of sat in the background, isn't there? You know, where sort of people are talking and that. They meet up with Michael Ironside's character, who's like the rich one of them.
Yeah. That's where we get Walken monologue number two when he's
But yeah, he's quite happy just to sort of sit there and in the background a little bit, and that everyone else sort of come to agreement as to what it is they're sort of doing. Once they get on the ground, he sort of takes a bit more control.
He does shoot a pilot from the plane.
Oh, that's funny.
Which I thought, hang on a minute, surely he's just like shattered the glass and everything. It was just like, no, everything seems to be fine. I was like, I'm not sure that's physically possible, but a lot of explosions and stuff. And
that sort of scene would be so interesting to sort of see how that came about. You know, is it a case of them turning around and going, yeah, you sat in the cockpit. We want you to pull your gun and shoot at another plane, you know, and just sort of see what sort of reaction you get from Chris Walken. Is just sort of say, well, that's just ridiculous. Or is it a case of Chris Walken going, I've got a great idea. What if I'm sat in the cockpit, right, and I pull my gun and I shoot the other plane? <You know? laughs> And they went, okay. You just don't know.
You kind of expect that sort of thing more from like Steven Seagal.
Exactly.
It's like Steven Seagal's playing a pilot. He doesn't understand how it works with planes and stuff. So he goes, yeah, I want to do this. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, Steve, fine. Just get it done. But the, There's some nice little, I mean, the character, the team around him, they're all really good. The actors are good and the characters are really interesting. So one of them is a medic. He's become a doctor. He's become a surgeon. And there's this great little scene when they go to recruit him, because it's actually before the recruitment scene.
Yeah, yeah. But that sort of character background of him and the...
He's clearly become quite jaded, because he's trying to save this life, and this person goes, "Oh, what are you bothering for? You know, we just let him die and we can use him for parts and stuff." Yeah. And he's like, I think the film has got this very cynical view of America. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this whole not getting involved in the South American problems, you know, just sort of letting things unfold, because the whole thing at the start is McBain's friend is leading this revolution. And they feel and they're under the impression that the CIA is going to jump in and support them and help them, they don't. So they basically, they're abandoned. And there's this sense of America sort of losing its way in the movie that they keep sort of touching back on. So a lot of things happen in the film like are really done intentionally. You can see that there's meaning there. So Maria Conchita Alonso and Chris Walken have a scene on a boat, but they filmed it with Liberty Island right behind them.
Oh yeah,
Statue of Liberty.
It's really funny, because they would never ever get permission to do that now. You would just not be able to do it.
No, but also just sort of the logistics of it. So they've clearly gone, right, we want to film this here. It's a symbolic thing. That it has to be, I mean, they could have done it with special effects or whatever, but you can see they've actually gone and filmed there, which, you know, they could have done that scene anywhere if they weren't worried about having the Statue of Liberty. So there's a lot of symbolism and stuff, which I think is quite interesting, in contrast to all the sort of kitchen sink kind of action stuff that they throw in, you know, with the rocket launchers and the big... The big revolution scene at the end where you know, the massive crowds are closing in on the president's palace and stuff. Sort of McBain and that sort of take a back seat at that point, because, you know, the revolution is the people.
They're just a spark, basically, aren't they? To sort of get things going.
There's a couple of, going back to the characters and their sort of interplay, one of the things was that they get these rocket launchers. Mm. They haven't used them before, because they haven't been active soldiers. Yeah, so they're reading instructions.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a lot of fun. And that's kind of works really well. And then there's a really silly, on a flip note, there's a really silly bit where there's a guy being, he's tied up by the villain, the baddies. I've got his name tied up. He's hanging from a ceiling fan. And this other bad guy comes in and he pulls the guy down from this seat.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's clearly a big heavy thing. And he grabs the fan and throws it off the balcony from the room. He throws it out over the balcony, and the guy who's tied to it follows it all the way over the balcony and down. And I'm thinking, well, there's no way that would happen. His body would get caught on the balcony at the very least, even if the thing was heavy enough to pull him. So it's just like a really excessive sort of unintentionally comical moment in the film, which, you know, if you're watching it at pace, you know, you kind of get past it, but then you're thinking, hang on a minute, that's not possible, that wouldn't happen. That's just ridiculous. And then right at the beginning, there's a scene where one of the rebels is pretending to be a prostitute, and she climbs up and she opens up there's like a little doorway underneath the president's desk, which, why would he have that there? And then it opens up, and then she's sort of holding this knife, and she goes to open his fly, but nothing happens.
Yeah.
Immediately cuts to him sort of standing up, and they don't really touch on that. So I don't know if that's a scene that got cut.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Because that's a very weird moment. It's like almost like she's going to have him literally by the balls, but it doesn't go there. He doesn't even acknowledge it. It's just like he just suddenly stands up. He's not got his trousers, you know, in a compromising position or anything. And he's being interviewed at that point, and he's speaking in English, Which was funny because at the end of the movie he doesn't really speak English. I don't know.
Yeah, it is a bit strange. So this is again, you know, it's on Amazon Prime. It's a pretty decent looking film from 1991, I believe. This came out.
Yeah, I think it was either 91 or 92. I think it was 91. Yeah, I'd never seen it before. I don't know about you, but it was. It wasn't everything I hoped it would be, but I'm glad I've seen it.
Yeah, I remember seeing the trailer for it back in the day, when, you know, at the beginning of the old VHS tapes. But yeah, never got around to seeing it at the time, unfortunately.
One of the reasons I always wanted to see it was because, you know, we all grew up with the Simpsons character, McBain. Rainier Wolfcastle, McBain. Apparently there was a sort of, I think the producers asked the makers of The Simpsons not to use the name McBain for a while because of the film, and that was why they introduced the Rainier Wolfcastle name. But I'm not sure if that's just legend or something, but yeah, I did kind of hope for a big Arnold Schwarzenegger-ish kind of moment from Walken. It's just such random, it's just an unusual casting. I mean, Christopher Walken is not the kind of guy you would expect to be cast in an action movie lead. But it does sort of touch back to like Dogs of War. But and also things like Men of War, the Dolph Lundgren film, I think it's similar kind of movie to that. And you know, it's not as bombastic as something like The A-Team or Expendables, as I say, but it's definitely a film of its time and well worth seeing if you like, you know, action movies.
Yeah, sort of a bit more like something like Uncommon Valor, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Is that Gene Hackman?
Yeah,
I haven't seen that.
Oh, that's a good one. Anyway, okay, so we're going to wrap up. This is the end of the show. So thanks, Rich, for joining me on this particular episode.
No problem at all.
So the short pop down will be linked into the footnotes, and you can find McBain in Amazon Prime. Go check it out. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.